Welcome to the Evolved Caveman, where men learn to be successful and happy with your host, Dr. John Schinnerer, as he shares the most impactful ideas and practices for you to get the most from your relationships, your work, and from your life. Now here's Dr. John.
Hey everybody, and welcome back to another action-packed episode of the Evolved Caveman. I am Dr. John, and it is my extreme pleasure to have with me today Cameron Harmon with Hermit Radio. And Cameron and I have become fast friends. We vibe a lot on the same issues. So Cameron, how you doing? Welcome to be here.
Thanks, man. I'm grateful to be here. It's been fun. The last couple of weeks has been fun getting to know you.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it too. So tell me a little bit about you at your very best, your story of kind of hassle to happiness.
Yeah. So much like most people, for me, I was a young kid and 9/11 kind of prompted me to join the military. And when I did, I thought it was going to be this, you know, this wonderful experience like the show Band of Brothers. And I found out quickly that it wasn't. And I found out that, you know, to be a man or to be a good soldier meant that you had to be a jerk and that you had to be mean and you had to be overly the top masculine, and anything that resembled weakness was not acceptable, was not tolerated. And that left me kind of an empty shell when I got out of the military. And, you know, being in Afghanistan and kind of dealing with PTSD and things like that, I had a hard time when I got out of the military. I didn't know who to be. I didn't know what was the real me anymore. And that kind of led me to a spiritual awakening. And I found kind of like my own peace, and I started Hermit Radio to help other people kind of do the same thing, kind of figure out themselves.
Awesome. Yeah. And so I think we'll have to unpack that story a little bit because there's a lot there. So tell me a little bit more about your childhood, like growing up prior to the Army. What was that like for you?
You know, I was a really good kid, I would say. I don't feel like egotistical for saying that. I was a really nice kid. I held the door open for people. And, you know, my parents did instill values in me that were of like a noble person. And all of that carried through up into my teen years. And when I wanted to be in the military, I kind of had this facade of who I thought I was going to be, you know, this like noble G.I. Joe. And I was going to do all these great things and, you know, serve my country. And literally, as soon as I got into basic training, I knew that all of that was non-existent.
What tipped you off?
Just the general interaction. You know, I mean, basic training is not a good place to really learn about the military anyways, because it's mainly just being screamed at and humiliated and mentally tortured to kind of like get you in the right mindset.
Which break is you down, build you up.
Yeah. Right. But when I was a kid, I was, like I said, a genuinely good kid. I tried to do nice things for other people. You know, I did community work. I worked for myself to make money. You know, I didn't rely on anybody really to do things for me. I had some good friends. I had really good values, I would say. And I carried that into the military with me. And in return, the kinds of things that I was confronted with was being called like a brown nose or a pussy, or, you know, a goody two shoe, because I wanted to be good and I wanted to get promoted. And even like physically, I wasn't at where they wanted me to be. I wasn't as, you know, strong or as fast as the top, right? Because they don't want you to be mediocre. They want you to be the best you can be. So when I came in and I wasn't that right away, you're an easy target, right? Nobody wants to get picked on. Nobody wants to be humiliated. So what do? They find people that are easy targets to pick on them. And whether that's right or wrong for the military, it's not for me to say. It does a really good job of producing soldiers. It makes people mean. It makes people tough. It does. It did that for me. But I was not the same person when I came out as the persons I went in as.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that I was talking with Ron Levant, who's like a, I don't know, expert in masculinity recently. And we were talking about why is shame so important for men and masculinity. I think it's one of the most powerful ways that we police one another by insult, right? Is, you know, stop being a pussy, don't be a bitch. And it's so easy to fall into that game. and so easy to use those put downs to manipulate other men or get them to change their behavior. And, you know, I get what they're doing in the military, and I'm thankful for the military. I understand that they're trying to break recruits down psychologically to build them back up in their mold with their values. And I see the reasoning for it. The process, I'm not a huge fan of in the way you're describing it. Although I've talked to other people in the military, and not everyone's experience has been like that. Although I do hear training camp is, you know, boot camp is unpleasant, to say the least.
True. And everyone's experience is definitely different. You know, what I recognized and realized was that you kind of had to fit a certain mold, and some people came in ready to be in that mold. You know, I mean, and I don't want to generalize people, but you know, if you're a high school jock and you go into the military, you're probably going to be successful. You're going to be good because you're already fitting in with the boys. Right. I wasn't that. I wasn't like a football player or anything like that. I just had a good heart and I wanted to serve my country. Mm-hmm. And the sad thing is that is not typically the kind of attitude that they really want. They want people that are willing to do whatever they're told and to be aggressive. And just like, for example, when I first became a team leader, and I was, to be clear for your audience, I was an infantry soldier, 11 Bravo. So I wasn't just some like pencil pusher or some, you know, desk jockey. Like I was a combat soldier. And when I first got promoted to team leader, my squad leader said literally to me, "Listen to me, no one is going to respect you the way you are. If you want to get respect and if you want to be good at your job, you need to be a pit bull, okay? You need to go so far and take it so far that I have to pull the leash back on you." He's like, "I'm not going to control you unless you get out of hand. But the goal should be to get out of hand to the point where I have to pull you back, because you want your people to be afraid of you, more afraid of anyone else." And to be fair, it did work. When I changed my attitude and adopted these principles, I did have soldiers that respected me only because they were afraid of me. I had a reputation. The biggest change was when I went from Fort Lewis, which is where I started. I got promoted there to sergeant. I deployed from there. A lot of my peers, they didn't really see me as like a leader yet, just because we worked together for so long. And that's typically why when you become a leader, they change you to a different unit, so you don't have that reputation. Mm. And so for me, when I went from Fort Lewis, Washington to Fort Campbell, I went into it with like the prison mentality. I'm going to be the biggest asshole I can be, and nobody will be able to touch me. And that's the mentality I had. I went in and I acted that way. I treated everything like that, and it worked. I was always the top team leader. People always talked about me. People always wanted me to be on their team or in their squad or whatever. And there were times I took it extremely too far, but that almost was better. That was more of what they wanted, was some crazy uncontrollable person that got results and produced fear.
It's interesting to me because I'm thinking as you're talking that, you know, there's two basic ways to motivate people: carrot, stick, love, fear. And, you know, you were being told, "Hey, look, you got to be an asshole. You've got to instill fear in those below you in order for them to respect you and follow you." And I can see where that's effective at times. Like they have to fear you more than they fear taking the bullet.
That's right.
And, you know, there's other studies that have shown in positive psychology, they've looked at human strengths in top military leaders, and they found that their top strength of some of the best leaders out there is love, which honestly surprised the hell out of me. And then it was kind of broken down for me as, well, you know, the people that respect their leaders, the people that respect their men or know that they're, sorry, their leaders, that they know that the leaders love them, they are also willing to run into firefights for that leader because they feel the love from them. They're giving love back. And I thought it's just kind of an interesting juxtaposition.
Yeah. You know, and I would agree with it now that I've been in and now that I'm out and I see the difference. But what I will say is that there's typically two types of leaders. There are the fear mongers, and then there are the loving type, right? And that's originally who I kind of wanted to be. I kept thinking in the back of my head, like, I don't want to be those guys. I want to be better than that. I want to teach my guys the right way. And, you know, and this is of course my own experience, but when I first got to be a team leader in Washington with my peers, they didn't respect me at first because I had once been one of their peers. So they didn't take me seriously. And when I started to kind of try and like bond with them and like be their friend, it just didn't work. They didn't respect when I would have to kind of crack down on them. You know, that's the problem with the military. Sometimes it's like, it's really easy to get in trouble, especially when you're bored and you're young, you're 18, 19 years old with nothing better to do than get drunk every weekend. It's really hard to stay out of trouble. And then that's where me comes into play as the team leader. The younger soldiers really don't get punished that bad, right? They might get, you know, physical punishment, or they might get restricted to base, but the team leader is the one who has to answer for it. The team leader is the one that has to go to the squad leader and say, hey, my guy got messed up this weekend and got a DUI or whatever, whatever. And that makes you look bad. That's a reflection. You get reviews and it's called an NCOER, non-commissioned officer evaluation report. And if your guys are slacking and if they're not meeting requirements, that's reflecting on you too. So it's kind of a no-win scenario, and that's what I realized. And when I changed my personality to be this more aggressive type of person, I got results. My guys were afraid, literally afraid of me to make mistakes, and they didn't. I mean, granted, they might have made mistakes here and there, but nowhere near what could have happened if I had been kind of buddy-buddy with them.
Now, this brings up a really interesting point to me, because one of the things I'm trying to teach men out there is to have the ability to shift gears to fit the context, the situation that you're in. And, you know, it seemed to me that your approach was adaptive, that you listened to what the people around you told you you needed to do, people in positions of power over you, and then you adapted yourself and you adjusted and you actually had success at it. What was your internal experience of this? Like, how did this make you feel is kind of my question.
Honestly, it led to this behavior, inevitably led to me doing steroids, because I now I had the mental personality of this raging asshole. I need to have the physical appearance of a raging asshole. So I started doing steroids, started getting muscular, getting big, and that only added to it.
When did that start, the steroids? Was that in the military or after you got out?
No, in the military. It was after I got back from Afghanistan. I had already been going to the gym, but I was kind of a little guy, like actually much like I am now. You wouldn't believe how I used to look. But back then I was like just really physically fit for the Army. I was like in really pristine, good shape, but I wasn't very big. I was kind of scrawny and I wanted to change that part of me too. So I knew friends in the military that had done steroids and had success with it. So I wanted to try it. And then as soon as I started putting on weight and seeing the physical difference, I was like, this is gold. I want to keep doing this. Mm-hmm. And I did.
It's addictive.
It is addictive. And I noticed that this was like this new me. I felt good. I looked good. People paid attention to me. You know, even my leadership, you know, they took notice of it. And that led to like, even like sometimes when you're in the infantry, you know, this was years ago, obviously, but like you roughhouse. Sometimes if you're that bored, you get into physical altercations just for the fun of it. Now I'm like physically able to manhandle people around me. And that feels good. That makes you literally physically and mentally in charge of the situation. And it's not even just about like, I don't even have to do much anymore. Now I'm so physically intimidated. They're like, dude, is this guy going to hit me? I don't know. I don't know if I want to talk to him or if I don't want to question him. And, you know, it's just a tough guy game. It's, you know, quote unquote, pardon my French, but a dick measuring contest. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter who you are, or what you are. You have to be the biggest one in the room or you mean nothing.
Yeah. And thank you for sharing that with me. So, so going back to that, my original question though, and let me give you some context. Right. So when I was a senior in high school, I was overachieving. And I mean, I was doing everything. And I'm sure from the outside looking in, it looked great. But my experience internally was, you know, I was stressed a lot. I was depressed some of the time. I was miserable. Like I just wasn't, and from the outside looking in, it looked great. From the inside out, it was just like, I don't get it. Like I'm not feeling this at all.
Yes. So the other thing to add to it was now I had just gotten back from Afghanistan. And before I even started doing the steroids, I started noticing that I had symptoms of PTSD and I really was struggling.
And what did you notice? What were the symptoms that you picked up?
First one was headaches. I came back and like just a month or two before we even come back from the tour, I got blown up by an IED. I hit my head on the roof of the truck and I really wasn't allowed to leave to go get it checked out. It would have made us, we were working in small teams. And if we had even had one person leave, it would have made it hard for our team to go out and do missions. So even though,
well, and then there's that masculinity piece of, right. Oh, I'm fine, coach, put me back in. Exactly. I mean, you know, like I'm fine. I'm tough. It didn't hurt me. Just a flesh wound.
Yeah. Me and the medic even talked about it. He's like, do you want to get medevaced? You know, cause I hit my head on the roof of the truck and I wasn't wearing my helmet. Oh. And he gave me an exam. It's called a MACE exam. And he basically asks you questions to see if you can remember them. I failed it miserably. Wow. And he goes, all right, man. He's like, this is on you. He's like, do you want to go get checked out? And I was like, well, was anybody else? And he goes, no. And I'm like, well, I'm not going. If nobody else is going, no way, dude. Like, I'm not going to be the only one to leave to go get help. And then when I got back, like I said, I started having these crazy symptoms like headaches. And then, you know, one night I was in bed with a girl I was with. The next morning I heard what I thought like crystal clear was an explosion. I was convinced. And I got out of bed, I ran outside and I looked around and there's nothing there. Mm. And I thought like, well, okay, maybe I just heard something. But the more I thought about it, I was like, no, I know what that was. I've just recently been in one. I know what that sound was. And that's how it started. And then I kind of just pushed it away and I stopped thinking about it. I had a horrible time. Like, and this is going to fit like what you're talking about. I went to my platoon sergeant. He's a wonderful guy. He was just doing his job. But I went to him and I told him, I'm like, hey, my sergeant, you know, I'm having some issues. I'm starting to have some headaches. I think I need to go get checked out. Like, I think I need to get like a brain scan and make sure I don't have any like trauma to my brain or anything. And he's like, okay, bitch boy, like go ahead, go get the crazy doctors to look at you, you know, whatever. And so it was like, well, I'm not going to go now. Like, I'm not going to go. I'm just been humiliated. I'm not
after you've insulted my masculinity.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not going to go.
And that's what I'm saying. That so those insults are such an easy way to manipulate us. And part of the reason for this podcast is just to make men more aware of it. Like, I just want to name the game so that we can step out of the game and go, dude, like, I know that man box shit. Like, you calling me a pussy is not going to change what I do. Like, I'm still going to work according to my values. It's interesting. I was talking to Andy Elwood, who's in England, and he volunteered after being a rope on a dope on a rope. He was in the British Coast Guard and would come down from the rope on a helicopter to help people stranded at sea or on, you know, burning oil rigs. After doing that, he volunteered to go to Afghanistan as a medevac person. And so he was the guy that would run out of the helicopter and rescue people, run into gunfire to rescue people. It was nuts. And he didn't have PTSD until he got back after that. And I remember his story, like he just said, I'm in the shower and this was a year or two later. And all of a sudden it got really hot and I could see the guy, there's a guy pinned under a Humvee and like I'm face to face with him. I can feel the sand. I can feel the heat. I can smell his blood. And it was smacked him in the face all of a sudden. He's like, I need to get help.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, the moment that I really had that feeling myself was years later when I got to Fort Campbell. I had a soldier who was kind of a scrawny little guy. I won't say his name just for that purpose, but
Steve Rogers.
Yeah, Steve. Exactly. Steve Rogers.
I'm a superhero. I'm a comic book geek.
No, it's good. He's a good depiction of him. Yeah. And, you know, they put him in my team because they, you know, the good old boy response when you've got somebody that's a good leader is you give the good leaders crappy soldiers to turn them into good soldiers, right?
Yeah.
Nobody else wants to deal with them. They give you kind of the leftovers. And this is what happened. They gave me this guy and I told him, I'm like, I don't want this soldier. Like, this guy's crap. Like, he's not what I want. So I went through the regular process of trying to get him kicked out. Like, I wasn't mad at him. Like, he didn't do anything wrong. He just didn't belong there. So I tried to go through the proper channels and they didn't listen to me and they didn't want to hear what I had to say. So I was like, fine, if I'm not going to help him get out on legally, I'm going to make this dude's life miserable until they have to take him away from me because they'll be afraid or something like that. And one day we're in the bay and I'm helping him set up his body armor. I'm helping him set up his kit so he knows how to do it right. And he gets a phone call. He gets a phone call in the middle of that. He picks it up and he starts crying. Drops his phone, just starts bawling. I'm like, Steve, what are you crying about? Why are you crying again? Like, in the middle of all of these people, you're crying. And he goes, my mom died. And without missing a beat, I said, good, I'm fucking glad your mom's dead. Put your fucking phone down and get back to work, you piece of shit. And I said that to him. I had no feeling whatsoever. I couldn't have cared less. Yeah. And all of the other soldiers in the bay, just stopped what they were doing because they all heard me say it. And they were like, oh my God, dude, that's a horrible thing to say. And he did. And he broke down. He had like a mental breakdown after that. And after that, somebody came up to me and they were like, hey man, like, I don't know what you've been through, but you need help. Like, you need to go talk to somebody. Like, he's like, I know that you're a tough guy and that you don't want people to talk to you or whatever, but he's like, you need to go get help. And so I kind of thought about it and I realized like what I had said to this kid was horrible. And the worst part was that I didn't care. I didn't feel anything. And so I thought that that was the problem. The fact that I didn't feel anything about that, what I had said to this kid. And then that's what started me going to counseling. And, you know, counseling works for a lot of people. It just didn't work for me. And maybe it's because I wasn't ready. I think that that was probably part of the problem. I just wasn't mentally ready to accept what anyone had to say.
Yeah. And thank you for sharing that. That was, it's a hell of a story. And I think, you know, it's interesting that we all get to that point where we're just like, oh shit. Like, yeah, that was a fuck up, or I shouldn't have done that, or I shouldn't have said that. Interesting that you say you didn't feel anything about it, because to me, like, two possibilities come to mind. And I bring this up because it's true for most men. And mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the things is that when we get depressed as men, it comes out as irritability and anger. The other possibility is alexithymia, which is really common for men. And it literally means we have no words for emotion. So we just don't know how we feel. And that's partly how we're socialized. The other thing that strikes me is you were just doing in a way what you were socialized to do. And it speaks to the power of socialization and the context around you. I mean, I remember there was a talk by Philip Zimbardo, who's a Hall of Fame researcher at Stanford, and he was an expert witness at Abu Ghraib. And, you know, Abu Ghraib's where they tortured the prisoners who were suspected of being terrorists, but many of them weren't, and they were just held without due process. And he went in to look at that, and one of his metaphors was, because everyone says, and it's the same thing with the police, you know, that they say, oh, it's just a few bad apples. Well, I think there's truth to that, that I think there are some bad cops. I think there are some bad soldiers. I don't think the percentage is very high. I mean, I would guess 10 to 15% if I had to put a number on it, but it's not just the bad apples. It's the fact that there's bad barrels and bad barrel makers. So, you know, the context that they're performing in, where superior officers were turning a blind eye to what they were doing, is kind of the bad barrels. The bad barrel makers are the people making policy in Washington, D.C., and asking them to do these things that there's no real clear-cut answer of how do we get information out of these people. And I think that's true for all of us. I think the older I've gotten, the more I've realized just how powerful that socialization process is. The context that we're in can influence our behavior.
Yeah, so true. My story, and that's why I feel like my story is so important to people who have experienced what I've experienced, because you are a product of your environment. I learned that the hard way. That was not me when I first went into the military. I had to become that way so that I could thrive, so that I could just be successful and not get picked on myself.
And so if I can jump in there, because there's layers of culture or concentric circles of culture. So one of yours was being in the military and learning how you had to adapt to survive and be successful in the military. And then the bigger one, the broader one that I talk a lot about, is sort of the man box culture and how we are socialized to be men. And one of the things that I want to do with this show is just get a little bit of distance between us, like me as John, and that concept of masculinity, like just an inch between me and it, so I can take a breath and look at it with some objectivity to say, okay, so this is how I was socialized. Is this how I want to be? Rather than just assuming it and being it because everyone else says this is what a man is supposed to be.
Yeah. One of the things that I had to do to kind of get over all of this stuff was I had to take responsibility for what I had done. I had to actually acknowledge that these things that I had done, these things that I had seen, that they were part of me asking for it, right? Beware what you wish for. My grandfather said that before I left. He tried to talk me out of it and not go in. But I told him that I needed to experience this for myself. I needed to know what this is like, otherwise I wouldn't understand it. And sure enough, here I am now. I do understand it now. And thankfully, I learned enough about myself that I could pull myself out of the mess that I had dug. It doesn't excuse anything I did. It doesn't change anything that happened, but at least I can be at peace with myself. Because I think a lot of what happened was that I was so ashamed of who I had become. I had to bury it with more masculinity. Yeah. Like I had to bury it with more things. Like the more of a jerk I was, that means I was the farther away from being, you know, quote unquote, a pussy. Right.
Right. And then I think you get in this negative spiral of, you know, thought, action, emotion, and you just keep going further and further from the goal.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's the whole thing is fascinating to me. So thank you for sharing that. There's a couple questions I have now. So what was successful in getting you past the PTSD?
Okay. So really self-analysis and meditation. In meditation, it just kind of freed up the gunk in my mind to help me be a little bit more clear. And, you know, exploring spirituality, different religions. The first thing that helped me kind of like get back on my feet was a book called Shambhala by Trogon Tsongpa. And this, what that means, Shambhala means sacred path of the warrior. Mm-hmm. And I could kind of resonate with this. I picked up this book kind of by intuition and I was like, this is interesting. Something called me to this book and I started reading it and it was talking about somebody who was so brave and so bold that they could be peaceful and kind and compassionate in any situation, no matter what. And I thought to myself, like, that's who I want to be. I don't want to be this person anymore. And when I got out of the military, I was dealing with a crisis, like an identity crisis, because I didn't know who or what to be anymore. My, you know, my brutish behavior wasn't acceptable in the civilian world. Like going to a regular job, you can't talk the way that you used to talk, mm-hmm. and you can't act the way that you used to act. That was a really hard lesson for me to learn. And when I realized I needed to change, I'm like, well, how do I change? Who am I going to be now? What different mask am I going to wear today? And I just made a choice. I made a choice that I wanted to be better than what I had been. I wanted to go back to the person I was before the military. And reading this book helped me understand how to be at peace. I needed to learn how to be at peace. I needed to learn how to accept what had already happened to me in my life and what I had done to other people. And I needed to let go of those things and not hang on to them. My biggest problem was hanging on to events from when I was in the military and when I was in Afghanistan and not letting go of them. It was weighing me down. And the minute I let go of them, it freed me up to kind of do something else.
Yeah. And I loved your line earlier of, I had to take responsibility for my actions. And that is so damn painful. And I do like the idea of, you know, when you have some self-awareness or self-discovery, that it's not an excuse for how you acted, but it is an explanation. Right. And the explanation, I think, is really helpful in making sense of how and why you did what you did. And okay, I've done that. Let me not do that again. Let me act in a better way moving forward, perhaps based on values. But yeah, that part's, I love that line of, it's not an excuse, but it's an explanation.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I needed. It's too painful. It's too painful to take it on. If you try to take your past and the things that, you know, the yucky parts of your past that you don't like, if you try to acknowledge those by just, you know, saying like, yep, I did this, then it's never going to work and you're never going to want to address it. But if you can, like you said, use it as an explanation, and it's so true. Once you do that for yourself, that is ultimately the foundation for the groundwork you need to do to see it in other people, which is what I try to talk about on my podcast all the time. Is it, you know, a murderer is still a murderer, but let's look at what made him or her become a murderer, right? Did they grow up in a poverty-stricken family? Were they abused and beaten when they were children? It's not an excuse. It doesn't make what they did right. But maybe we can understand people a little bit better if we stop looking at things at face value and look deeper into it. In Buddhism, they call it the looking through with Dharma eyes or Buddha eyes. And it's all it is really seeing the true nature of people, not just accepting the face value.
Well, and I think that explanation also from the outside in gives us, or can help give us, compassion for that person and understand their story at a deeper level, which I think is really powerful. I wanted to back up a second, because one of the questions which always interests me is, you know, when we men are building up muscle on our body, whether by steroids and weights or whatever it is we're doing, I'm always curious in my mind. I'm like, to what extent am I trying to build up that muscle as armor against emotional pain? Do you think that was true in your case?
100%. And the way that I got to that conclusion was I tore my right pectoral muscle twice from just lifting too heavy, being too egotistical. And the second time that I tore it, I kept asking myself, like, God, is this worth it? You know, I also, at that time, I wanted to be a bodybuilder. I was training to do competitions and prep for those competitions. And I would make myself miserable with the amount of steroids I was taking and the amount of food I had to eat or mm-hmm. a lack of food I had to eat. It was just all miserable. And I kept wondering, like, why am I doing this? Like, I look great, sure. But half the time I look in the mirror, I don't even see what's actually there. Why am I doing this? Especially after I tore my pec, I'm like, is this worth it? Am I going to actually be this bodybuilder person I want to be? Or am I going to break my body down so bad I can't even use it anymore? And when I did that, I was like, oh man, maybe I'm doing this for alternate reasons. Maybe I just want to look good and have people like me or build up this armor, like you said.
Or yeah, keep people away, just intimidate the shit out of them.
That's right.
Because it seems like that was sort of your MO in the military, that if I'm enough of an asshole, pardon me, I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
And if I get big enough, then it just keeps people at arm's length and I don't have to deal with them as much.
It's true. And it can be said for a lot of people too, you know, not just me and not just any one person, but you know, a lot of guys do that. You know, a lot of guys have to be the macho G.I. Joe guy. You know, you see it in the military. You see it especially in combat jobs. You know, there are the people who are that and who are not. And the ones who are not are the ones that get picked on and get, you know, tortured all the time. And that's who I didn't want to be.
I know a guy who, I've known him since high school and, you know, done some work with him. And I remember him leaving from high school to go into, he went into special ops. I think he became an Army Ranger. And he came back after he was about 25, 26, after he'd done a couple tours in Afghanistan. And this guy, his forearms were bigger than my thigh. Whereas when he was in high school, he was my size. And I was like, wow, like that's amazing. And so he had led, you know, special ops tours in Afghanistan and then got out of the military, then joined a motorcycle gang club. and I remember, I'm never sure what the right terminology is there. I guess it depends on the people. And these guys would wear their leather jackets to like biker conventions. And I remember him telling me this story of some drunk guy coming up to him in like some casino somewhere. And he put his hand on his shoulder and thereby touched his jacket, his colors, his leather. And one of the other guys in the gang or the bike club came over and was like, dude, what the fuck are you doing? Like, you don't let anybody touch your colors. Like next time that happens, you got to pop him in the face. And it really kind of started this questioning, like, is this where I want to be in this group where I'm supposed to, you know, destroy somebody just for touching me, whether he's drunk or friendly or whatever. And I think that's kind of, that's the extreme that we can get to where you just, you know, hit first, ask questions later.
Yeah, it's true. It's the same mentality in the military. And that's why you see common similarities between, you know, biker clubs, right? The military, football teams, any sports team, you know,
that's any paramilitary organization, fire, cops.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And this is why I think that this conversation is so important as far as like when we're talking about police officers, there's a lot of things people are really quick to judge police officers. But again, if we're going to do the work to look at why a murderer is doing what they're doing, we should also be fair and do that for cops. Okay. Let's look at real statistical numbers here. There's a lot of cops that are ex-military people, okay? Mm-hmm. What I'm about to say does not excuse anything, but here we are again with an explanation. Cops with the same military training go into being a cop doing the same things that they've already been trained how to do. The police training boot camp is nothing compared to being in the military and doing the real deal, okay? That training doesn't go away. And when you're trained to defend yourself, anything is a threat. Okay. When I was in Afghanistan, if somebody looked at me the wrong way, I'm already flipping my safety from safe to fire, ready to shoot. And that's just the reality. Okay. Again, this doesn't excuse anything. This is just reality. Any one person can take your life away at any given moment. It doesn't matter if they're wearing a uniform, because in Afghanistan, Not a single one of those people were wearing uniforms. They were wearing what everybody else was wearing. They used women and children as shields to hide bombs, they, all kinds of things. Now, in America, it's different. Cops, in the military, you go overseas and you do your business overseas and then you come back to the States. Cops do their business where they live, mm-hmm. okay? They're never in a safe place. They got to do what they do 24/7, 365 days a year. So that's kind of like being in Afghanistan for years and years and years on end. It's not always fair to say that these cops are just, you know, running and gunning and doing the wrong thing. They're making mistakes, but let's look at why they're making mistakes and then therefore make corrections to either their training or their recruiting process. You know, like there's lots of things that can be done.
Well, yeah. It's interesting. Like I was talking to a cop this weekend in Oxnard and great young kid, like 25, 26, I would guess. And he grew up, you know, kind of surrounded by gang members and then decided to become a cop and was saying he's the first person in his extended family that went on the other side. And he was saying that, yeah, he's like, I don't know when I leave my house to go walk my dog, he's like, the question in my mind is, should I bring my handgun for protection? And, you know, I was telling him, look, you know, I see both sides, the Black Lives Matter and, you know, supporting the police. Like I support both those.
Me too.
I'm really for racial equality. I think that there has been a lot of unjust police violence. I think there are some bad apples. I think there's a bad system in place too. I also realize that the police in our country are being asked to do an impossible job, in my opinion. I think, you know, because of so many cuts to social programs, you know, they're being asked to deal with homelessness, they're being asked to deal with domestic violence, they're being asked to deal with drug abuse, they're being asked to deal with mental health issues. They shouldn't have to deal with that stuff, maybe domestic violence, but I mean, they should have to deal with people breaking the law.
Yes.
And the more serious stuff. And, you know, I think that you're absolutely right. You know, the PTSD that they get, whether from military or being in the police force, creates this amped up sympathetic nervous system response where you easily go to fight, flight, freeze, or you're always in fight, right. flight, freeze. And then if your finger's on the trigger, it's hard to stay calm in those split seconds where you have to make a decision of whether or not to fire. And so I think that there's, you know, I support both sides of the issue. I understand both sides. I have clients on both sides of the issue. And it's a very thorny, difficult issue. I think one of the issues is to get police more training in something like mindfulness and mental health.
Yes.
So that they are more aware of what's going on internally. They are more aware of sympathetic versus parasympathetic. They are more aware of symptoms around PTSD or depression.
Yeah. And we need to be honest about this stuff. You know, like, again, the problem in America is we don't want to talk about shit because we're so divided and we're so, you know,
triggered by emotion.
We're triggered by everything right now. We got to just stop and just like literally take a breath and be like, okay, we have some real problems right now, but we need to be adults and talk about this to figure out what the problem is. Okay. And I've tried to really keep my mouth shut about the whole police thing because I, like you, I am on both sides and I don't want anyone to get offended by what I say because I'm just one person, but you know where I can get on? Have you ever had to run and chase somebody down in the middle of the night before? Have you ever had to deal with somebody who may or may not have a gun on them and you got to try to talk to this person?
And you don't know.
That you don't know. Have you ever had to point a gun at another person because you're afraid for your life? Anybody that is giving cops a hard time right now, if they can't answer those questions, then they need to do some real self-analysis about what they're thinking and saying and doing before they judge anyone else. Okay. Now, to be fair, the things that are being talked about right now, they're wrong. No cop should shoot anybody in the back ever. Okay. Yep. That's wrong. Nobody should stand or put their knee on somebody's neck while they beg for their life. That's wrong. Nobody should shoot somebody in their house in the middle of the night when they're trying to sleep. That's wrong. But if we're not going to trust cops to do their job, then just get rid of them. Right. But you can't have it both ways. You can't be so critical and harsh on them while at the same time afraid to lose them. Okay. So instead of my thing and where I come from is maybe we shouldn't be so quick to judge. Maybe we should come up with some solutions. Come up with real viable things that work and do it from an understanding that you have never been in their job. And so it's hard for you to accept and understand what they're going through. Just as much as we don't know what it's like to be a murderous, you know, drug dealing criminal. Okay. If we can have compassion for criminals that are doing wrong and find ways to help them and get the stuff they need, then we should also be capable of doing the same thing for our police, law enforcement, and military people too. I don't know what the right answer is, but certainly not getting mad and yelling and screaming at each other on Facebook, that's certainly not helping. Let's come up with some solutions. Let's actually work with lawmakers and talk about what could be a real solution. You know, what we're talking about funding and stuff. You can't say that we want to give them more training while also taking away their funding. One thing that I do see with the police that is a problem is the over-militarization of police officers. You can't even hardly tell the difference anymore. Like, mm-hmm. I can't even tell you how many times I see police officers rolling around in camo and stuff like that. It's unnecessary. There's rules and laws, even in the Geneva Convention, that prohibit that kind of behavior because we need to be able to tell the difference. Mm-hmm. Police officers used to be a peacekeeping unit, right? Their jobs, I mean, the original police officers didn't even have firearms. They had a nightstick, and that was what they do. If you look in the UK, I believe in London, their police officers don't carry firearms. I think they have just non-lethal stuff.
Yeah.
Look, I'm not saying that's what we need to do. I'm just saying, like, let's talk about it. Let's have a conversation.
A rational conversation. Yeah.
Right.
I agree. Yeah. And so switching subjects. So let's move to relationships. So okay. How have your expectations about being in relationship with a partner, someone, a significant other, changed since high school?
Okay. This is a good one, just because I've had so many failures with relationships.
Oh, so you must know a lot then.
Yeah. I'm not saying like a guru or anything, but I definitely have had my own experiences.
But that's how we learn.
That's right. For me, understanding what love actually is was the number one thing that helped me understand what relationships are really about. And this isn't a rip on my parents, but I don't know that I ever really got told what love is. I certainly didn't learn about it in school. Like, I mean, nobody ever spilled it out to me that, hey, this is what love is. So growing up in high school, going into my, you know, young adult life, into the military, the only thing I really knew was that I wanted to have sex. And that when I had sex with somebody, to me, that felt like they trusted me enough to be in a relationship with them. That to me became the identifier for love, was sex. And then doing steroids really didn't help that situation at all. And so I found myself being this, you know, kind of a quote unquote horny maniac, and thinking that that is really what love is that I just need to have this physical aspect of it. I didn't really learn what true love is until I met my current wife now. And what singled that out for me was learning about trust. Trusting another person to not hurt your feelings, or at least to have your back. And if they do hurt your feelings, that you can talk about it. When I started to learn about that and really embrace it, the physical aspect stopped becoming such an important thing. Having safety and security in another person, that became my new identifier for love. And when I looked back, because I've done a lot of self-reflection, I looked back on all my past relationships and I drove all of them away and made them hate me because all I wanted was one thing. I never actually asked them, what do they want? Like, what do they expect out of me as a partner? What kinds of things do I need to do to make you happy? I had the very classic, typical man idea of a relationship that I'm in the army, I'm this soldier, I'm going to work every day. You know, I have needs and I have desires and this and that. And it's like, dude, you're one of two people in this like conversation in this relationship. And it's not always about what you need. And that was the biggest thing I needed to learn, was it's not always about me. And I needed to learn how to trust. And when I did that, it just opened up a whole new world of possibility for me.
Yes. I really like the idea of safety and security in relationship, whether that's in your, you know, personal relationship with your significant other, with, you know, parenting your children, or at work. You know, I think that if we don't feel safe and secure, we've effectively cut off half of the positive emotions available to us. We're generally putting people into a fight, flight, freeze response, at least at some level, it might be a minor level, but when you get into that level, we know you can't create, you can't innovate, you can't think outside the box, you can't problem solve that well. You're limited in your thinking to how do I get out of here? How do I fight back? Or how do I blend into the background so that nobody notices? And, you know, I think that one of the things I realized in my 50 plus years is that we all, or the vast majority of us, are very exquisitely emotionally sensitive beings. And if we go into any conversation with that assumption, then I think we can go in with more curiosity, more compassion, more gentleness, like a gentler use of language. And the result generally comes out 10 times better.
Yeah. Something that's helped me was reading, I don't know if you're familiar with this person. His name is Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful, wonderful human being. And he's got two books that I've read that are wonderful. And one of them is called Anger.
Yeah, great Just book.
Great book, right? And what is he talks about relationships a lot in that book. You know, think about like how he words his things, you know, darling, you know, whenever he's referring to somebody speaking to their partner, it's always in the most gentle and mm-hmm. compassionate way. And I just kept thinking like, what would that look like if I could do that? If I could talk to somebody that same way. And I do it now. Now I know how to do this. And I react this way. I try anyways. When somebody's overly emotional about something, it's like I see a reflection of who I used to be in them. And I know what this is. I've identified it. But the problem here that we avoid is the identification, or maybe the awareness. Maybe it's both. Awareness of this and then the identification of it later. But if you see this in somebody else, you can take a step back, kind of like what you were talking about, stepping out of the masculinity thing and just, you know, I don't need to play this game, right? We can do the same thing in relationships with, you know, our partners or friends and whatever. And, you know, just be like, maybe this isn't a good time to talk about this right now. Mm-hmm. Let's table it, right? Because what happens, right? Like we flight or fight, it's this thing that always kicks in somehow. Even if you're talking to somebody you love, boom, here we are. Now we're fighting and my heart's beating out of my chest and you're saying things. And now I'm saying things that we don't really mean, but we're saying them anyways. And then what happens after? Then you calm down and you come back. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say that. But you've left a damage. You've left an impression on this person, whether you wanted to or not. Our words are like weapons, whether we want to accept it or not. And so when the more that we can adjust our, you know, fire rate or our words, the better we are at communication. You know, like our little monk friend said, you know, like, darling, I'm sorry that my words have hurt you. What can I say or what can I do to bring you comfort? You know, and some people might be not into that because it sounds too compassionate, but maybe that's the problem. Maybe
we need to get more compassionate.
Right. Maybe you need to be a little bit more sensitive and not care so much what the other person says.
I mean, I love the idea from Terry Real that most relationships don't end due to a huge transgression like an affair. Most relationships end via death by 1,000 paper cuts. And those paper cuts are absurdly tiny, like being ignored when the other person's on their phone or coming home late for dinner or not responding to a text immediately, or, I mean, a look or a tone of voice, or, I mean, it goes on and on and on. They're very, very small, but they accumulate over time. Mm. And over time, your perception of your partner goes from all positive to all or mostly negative. And then it becomes problematic. And, you know, I just think that one of the things we got to get better at is reducing those paper cuts.
Yeah.
And the first step is awareness.
Yes. I like what you said. You brought up my favorite word is perception. And that's really what I talk on a lot. Our perception is everything. Mm-hmm. Okay. What, just like you said, right? We fill our heads up full of our little perceptions that may or may not even be true, right?
Right.
How many times have you asked your partner, right? How many times have you asked your partner what's wrong? And they say nothing, but you don't think it's nothing, right? You think like,
or oh, you man, say it's nothing and you know damn right. well it's not nothing.
Yeah. And your mind just lets it go wild with all kinds of things while she's cheating on me. You know, she's mad at me. And we keep poking and we keep trying to get answers when we already did get an answer. And even if it's not true, even if there is something wrong, there's a reason they don't want to tell you that there's something wrong. So in that instance, the compassion part is just allowing them to have that moment and trusting that what they're saying is true. Because outside of that, all you can do is assume something else, and that's never going to work. Change perception.
And I also, along that vein, I also like the idea of checking the story that you're telling yourself, being aware that you're telling yourself a story, which may or may not be true, you know, that we do create these stories all the time about how we interpret other people's actions. And to have the permission within your relationship to say to your partner, hey, honey, I'm telling myself a story right now that, you know, you came home late from work because you were interested in another guy at work. Is there any truth to that? And that I would say is an act of vulnerability, right? You're saying, look, I'm concerned. I'm worried.
Yeah. And you don't know unless you ask. Mm-hmm. And if you ask, whatever answer you get, you need to accept it. Because what happens if you don't?
85% of what we worry about, the outcome is actually far more positive than how we're worrying about it.
Correct.
That's a study that I came across a while back. It's a beautiful one.
Here's a funny one. How about like when you're in a new relationship with somebody and you're just starting out and you're texting, right? And they don't respond right away. Maybe they don't even respond for a couple of hours. And what do you do? You're like, what are they doing? They don't want to talk to me. They're mad at me. I blew it. I've lost it. And then they text you back another hour later. And they're like, sorry, I was asleep.
Yeah. Yep.
We do it to ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So great conversation on relationships. So thank you for going there with me. Just in wrapping up, what advice do you have for other men who may not be as far along on their journey as you are?
I think to just have patience. I think that if you are one of these people that we're talking about, if you are experiencing something like this right now, I think that you need to understand that you are just a person. You don't have to be a man. Okay. You can just be who you want to be. I would suggest that if you're struggling with this, make a list of all the things that you enjoy. And in that list, do any of those things require you to be a jerk or require you to be aggressive in any way, shape, or form? If you want to be a gaming person and record yourself playing video games, then do that. If you want to be gay and you want to love another man, do that. There's nothing wrong with who you want to be. You know, women are embracing this right now. Women are being who they want to be all the time, anytime. It's, you know, it's okay to let your guard down. It's okay to be who you want to be. And I think that listening to this podcast, the Evolved Caveman podcast, this is a good start. Listening to this kind of conversation is a good start. And just ask questions, seek out information, and trust your own heart. Trust who you want to be. Don't worry about what other people think.
Yeah, absolutely. Good advice. And I think that I like the idea of just let's agree as men that there's not one ideal form of masculinity to which we are all trying to aspire, which can't be the case because masculinity is a social construct and therefore is dictated by culture to some extent, to a large extent. And I think just giving ourselves permission to be whatever kind of masculine we want to be is a great start. So Cameron, where can people get a hold of you? Where can they find Hermit Radio? What else are you up to just in wrapping up?
Yeah, thanks. So you can check out my website. It's hermitcast.com. You can find me on all the social medias as Hermit_Radio. My podcast is on any platform. You can listen to podcasts. And I do write articles here and there, but I'll typically post the articles to my website or to my social media posts. If you want to read some of those, I've talked about similar conversations. So if you want to see those, that's where they'll be.
All right, Cameron, thank you so much for joining me today. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. It was a good talk.
Absolutely. And that is it for this episode of The Evolved Caveman. Thanks so much for joining us. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.